This is Mike Burns, recorded by Chris Alden Lee on the 13th of April 2011. Mike Burns, Part 1.
Mike Burns, family name is Frederick Michael, born in London, 16th of December 1942, war baby.
So you're now?
Coming up to 68 last year, so 69 this year.
What sort of education did you have, Mike?
Well, I went to the primary school in... We left London probably when I was about three or four and went north, which is where my mother came from. She was from County Durham. And went to the local primary school in a town called Sunderland in the northeast of England. I always recall having got to the 11 plus exams... And we eventually got the results. My father had promised me, as like a true Scot, that he'd buy me a bicycle if I passed my 11 plus. And hence, the day that the letters came round, I was obviously overjoyed because the bike was going to come. I passed my 11 plus. And I recall going back to, or going into school that day, the primary school, and there was obviously quite a kerfuffle with the kids in the class. And our form teacher sort of told us all to shut up and why were we so noisy? And, or please, sir, we've got the results for the Bede, which was the Bede Grammar School for boys in those days. And it was just referred to, we've got the results for the Bede. Mm-hmm. Or who's passed, he said. So I put my hand up, and two other lads put their hand up. And I just recall him looking at me and saying, Burns, you've passed, with pseudo-astonishment. So I went to grammar school, I think, in those days, there were four streams. There was an A and a B and a 1 and a 2. Which was sort of a pleasantry. I think the one A and B were probably languages, and the one and the two were probably technical studies for a different aptitude or IQ. And I think I got to the third or fourth year at the grammar school and had managed to catch up the other two lads that came from the initial primary school. And having done that, I just switched off completely. So I left school at 16.
So you're not really an academic kind of guy?
No. But I think I was bored. I'd obviously set myself a target to catch these other two lads. And after that, it was, dare I say, it was wine, women, song that appealed to me more. So I left school at 16. My father refused to sign me up for the RAF, which is, you know, sort of why not was my approach. And he organised that I do an apprenticeship. However, I think after 2 years of the apprenticeship, 3 years of the apprenticeship, what with day release, which was one day a week, and three nights at college, it was pretty hard work. And so at that point, I decided the best way out of this was to try and do a sandwich degree course. So I applied for it and got on to a sandwich degree course.
And we're talking about engineering, aren't we?
That, I think that was called applied physics. So it was mainly maths, physics and electronics were the disciplines that we did. And it started off, in those days, there was the Council for National Academic Awards. And I think in my third year on the course, it became BSc asterisk. And on the final year, it became BSc honours, which was great. Because obviously, in later life, when the BAS scholarship, the MSc course came up, I was obviously qualified to apply for that. So left school early, but the pressure of doing day release and evening classes made me think, no, finger out and get down to it.
And do so you went for it?
Oh, yeah.
And got it?
Yeah.
Well, how old would you have been when you got your qualification?
Probably, I would think, probably about 22 or 23. It's when I came out with the first degree, which was, as I say, in applied physics.
What did you do with it?
Well, it was a sandwich course, so I think the first two periods, 6 months at college, 6 months in industry. So the first two periods, I was actually sponsored by a company called Thorn AEI that made television tubes in Sutherland and a production factory. So the first two summers, I obviously went to them, and variously did quality control engineering in the fabrication of TV tubes. Spent some time in the glass technology because the factory was subdivided into two. One of them used to make the television envelopes, the tubes, and then they effectively used to sell them to the manufacturing company that put it all together and made the TV set. So that was 2 years. I decided that I didn't think the training was that good, the industrial training, so I applied to become college-based and went to the local authority for a grant. And so my third and fourth years, I actually became grant-aided rather than a salary, which obviously was a drop in salary. And my first industrial period on my own was at Chapel Cross, which was a nuclear power station near Annan in Dumfriesshire. And I was joined the health physics department there. Went back to college for my final year, and after my final year at college, did another 6 months industrial training, which was in Appleby Frodingham, United Steel Company in Scunthorpe, which is the worst job I've ever had in my life, and it scared the pants off me.
Why was that?
Well, as part of Appleby Frodingham developing this steelworks, the local council said, well, you know, there's a lot of land there that's on an estate. And I think that the main old house was called Bromby Hall. So Appleby Frodingham had to do this old house up and turn it into apartments for apprentices. So I found myself driving to work, probably 4 or 5 miles from this Bromby Hall into the steelworks, and all you could see was just a huge, great cloud of muck rising up into the sky above this facility. So that was fairly depressing, but my duties were to do ultrasonic testing of steel plate, which started off as about metre by metre by about 3 metres ingot size. And it either turned out from the rod and bar mill, probably the size of your small finger, as a rod. Having started at about 0.5 mile an hour, it used to come out at the other end at about 60 miles an hour. And frequently, the expression was it might cobble, which was as it was increasing speed, it would get to the next set of rollers, which were obviously reducing it in size, and it wouldn't go through the rollers and it would just burst out like spaghetti, which was probably 20 foot high and probably an expanse of about 20 or 30 foot wide, fairly sort of hot orange-coloured steel. The other thing was the ultrasonic testing of steel plate, where I used to wear clogs and go on top of the steel plates from the mill and test them for air or imperfections within the plate.
Whilst they were still hot?
Whilst they were still hot, hence the clogs. to do the ultrasonic testing, I obviously used to go on with a water source that would give me coupling between the steel, the hot steel, and the ultrasonic transducer. But whilst you were doing this, there would be overhead cranes going around with magnetic couplings, carrying plate that had already been made. And unlike Mickey Mouse or Donald Duck that you see in the cartoons, I didn't think if I came out sort of, I got squashed to 1/4 inch, that I would just reinflate. So I was scared at that job.
Really? Mm. What year was this?
Well, without sort of looking at notes, it was probably around 66, 67.
That seems quite late for a complete disregard of health and safety regulations.
Yes, yes.
So that's what they were doing.
But I mean, I think some industries in those days, you know, it wasn't invented. The coal mines, people were expended.
Was there a recognised injury rate?
Oh, I don't think there was any statistics.
Right.
No.
But
certainly at my level, in the engineering side of it, I was never aware of statistics.
So how do you get yourself out of that rather awkward corner?
Well, one of the wonderful things at this Bromby Hall was that, as well as the dripping and bread sandwiches that we used to have on an evening, which was quite archaic. We used to get daily newspapers, and we used to get the Daily Telegraph delivered. And I still have the advert, which I copied out from the Daily Telegraph. And it was in the scientist and technologist vacancy section. And I believe the advert read something like, ionospheresist required for the British Antarctic Survey, research facilities available, graduates wanted, research facilities available, salary approximately 997, apply to Bill Sloman, British Antarctic Survey in London. So I quickly went to a library, found a dictionary, and looked up to see what the hell an ionospheresist was, because I had no idea, and wrote off the post. So I got a very pleasant letter back from Bill Sloman saying that the post had been filled. However, there was a post for a marine geophysicist. Might I be interested? So I went back to the same library and looked up to see what a marine geophysicist was. And duly applied for that job.
How do you actually... What kind of knowledge did you have of the Antarctic at that point? I mean,
skimpy.
Where did it come from?
Well, I think probably the first recollection would be around the time of the John Mills movie. And
Scott of the Antarctic.
Scott of the Antarctic. And I can't quite remember, but I think probably we either had a trip out from the grammar school to church to commemorate a particular anniversary of Scott, or we were all trudged along to the local cinema to actually see the movie. So that was the first sort of images and interest.
Were you in? Was it? Did it impress itself upon your mind at that point? Or was it just another film?
No, I think it impressed myself. You know, here are these guys, you know, doing this for the country and glory. And not that I would have probably put it in those words at the time. I just found it sort of, you know, quite a good, thrilling story.
So when you saw the advert in the Telegraph, you knew roughly what the Antarctic was like?
Well, yes. Obviously, from if it was going to be identical to the John Mills movie, then yes. But I know when I finished at my degree course, there were about 10 or 12 of us on this sandwich course. Probably half of them had come in from industry and half had come straight from A-levels. So it was quite a mix of intake. And after the final exams, we all went around to the local pub or the students' union bar and obviously had a few beers. And the lads were sort of saying, oh, what are you going to do? Some of the lads were sponsored by the coal board. So there was one lad, oh, I'm really looking forward to going back to the coal board. You know, have a career for life there. Some of the guys were thinking that they wanted to go and work in one of the high-tech shipyards on the Tyne, because in those days, I think shipbuilding was beginning to go, you know, on its uppers, Tyne side, Weir side. One of the lads was very keen on driving his car, which was a Morris Minor split windscreen car, vintage obviously nowadays, and he wanted to go and work at the Road Research Lab at Crowthorne, testing cars. And I think somebody said to me, yeah, what do you want to do, Mike? And I said, well, I wouldn't mind going on an expedition somewhere like the Antarctic or somewhere like Everest or, you know, doing a bit of climbing.
This is before you saw the advert?
Yes, yeah. But I'd been interested in climbing, and I think probably about 2 or 3 years earlier, I'd come up to the north of Scotland from the first winter of snow and ice climbing and just thoroughly enjoyed it. So I met up with some guys that were ex-Glasgow University, and we just had a great time.
So you applied for this job as a geophysicist, having checked out
what the hell it was.
Yeah. And I guess you got an appointment.
Yeah, basically, I think what happened was I went down to London, somewhere near, I think it was Victoria, or just around from Buckingham Palace.
Gillingham Street?
Yeah, Gillingham Street, that's it. So, obviously saw Bill. I had to go and see the old doc that used to do the medicals in those days. So I went through all the formal interview process. I was then, I think Bill Sloman then wrote back to me, or either Bill or Eric Salmon, wrote back to me saying that they were prepared to offer me the post, but one final thing had to be done. Could I go to Birmingham University and just have a chat with... the guy was Professor Griffiths at Birmingham, the geophysics department, which was a sub-department of geology. Because basically I was being seconded from Bath, being paid by Bath, but seconded to work for the geophysics department in Birmingham University. So from Appleby, Frodingham in Scunthorpe, it was probably about a 2 or 3 hour drive across to Birmingham. And had, let's say, a very, very informal interview. I mean, they were just so pleased that Bass were going to fund somebody to, you know, assist with their research programme in the Antarctic.
But why you? Did you ever work out why it was that you were selected?
Well, probably the position was to go offshore and be involved in collecting data, geophysical data. And there were two particular techniques we were using. One was a gravimeter, which was a standard piece of kit that is you can buy off the shelf from manufacturers, which measures the Earth's gravitational attraction. And you can make inferences into the geology of an area by doing a gravity survey. The other instrument we used was a thing called a proton magnetometer. And that happened to have been built by a company called, I think it was Cambridge Consultants, that had built this device. It was semi-sophisticated in the fact that it was supposed to be or have a capability of auto-tuning. I think they'd endeavoured to use it for one season doing marine geophysics in the Scotia Arc area, and it had been a bit of a nightmare. We were trying to keep this thing going. So they were looking for somebody to probably spend about 2 or 3 months in the geophysics department, refurbish this bit of electronic kit, and also to get involved in seismic work, which was the first single ship seismic work they were going to be doing using what was called air gun technology. They had used a lot of dynamite before and things called sonobuoys, but this was going to be a new venture for Bass, for the Birmingham Geophysics Department. So I think, clearly, with a degree in maths, physics and electronics, I seemed to fit the bill. And when I mentioned that I'd been working at Appleby, Frodingham, didn't quite say I hated it, but I'd been using ultrasonic testing. This, here comes the sound, the sonics part of it, and obviously the electronic part of it.
So actually you were pretty well ideally qualified for this rather unusual post.
Academically, yes.
And obviously you like rock climbing.
Yes. I mean, but as far as sort of aptitude and mentality, this was all going to be an unknown, really.
Well, but did you not sense that Bill Sloman and whoever else was interviewing you was actually sussing you out at the time? Or later on did it occur?
No, I didn't. I mean, I think at that time, I think it was the second time that I went south, because that was obviously, as I referred earlier, that was just a summer Charlie going down on the Shackleton to do the work. I think I had to stay back. I missed the Shackleton sailing from Southampton and went and flew down to Montevideo.
Second time or first time?
This was the first time.
Yeah.
First time I'd ever flown in an aircraft at the tender age of 22 or 23. I'd never ever flown before.
Right.
And I recall that the coffee from Heathrow to, I think the first stop was probably Paris, Madrid, Recife, Rio, and then Montevideo, and the coffee got smaller and smaller and stronger and stronger. And I kept on thinking, you know, how on earth can this plane stay up? I mean, these engines must be getting pretty hot. There's another lad that came down with me, or I went down with him. He'd been down several times before, a guy called David Petrie, who was involved with Charles Swithinbank doing the glaciology, the sounding programme. So we joined, I think, the John Biscoe in Montevideo, and then went south and did all the marine geophysics work, and then back to Birmingham. And for my second trip, which was clearly then going to be a wintering trip, I went down to Cambridge. I think it was Corpus Christi, where it was more or less a bit of an indoctrination. Bunny Fuchs would give us lectures as to how to be safe in crossing crevasse bridges and things. And I think there was quite a culture of, let's get some beer down these lads and see, you know, how they fit. Mm-hmm. No attribute testing or psychological testing, just see how they behave. So, yeah, quite interesting, just the way that Bass put people together.
Let's backtrack slightly then. What was the salary like compared to Scunthorpe?
Oh, probably about 10 or 15% more, so it was good. And I think, actually, the figure of 997 by the time I've actually joined probably had gone to 1,100 or something. So it was a good job. And for me, it looked like I could go and do this exploration thing or travel the world exploration thing, but I was clearly affiliated or involved in my professional academic qualifications.
So you're earning a living and also improving your sustainability later.
Yeah. Although I always recall having finished completely with Bass and meeting up with some old colleagues, and one of them who had come from the oil industry and had gone to Birmingham to do a master's degree in geophysics, he had done that solely for the purposes of his career advancement in the seismic industry. And I always recall when I finally finished with Bass, meeting up with him for an evening meal and a few drinks with some other friends. And his first opening gambit was, so that must have been 3 or 4 years wasted, Mike. In other words, you really should have joined an oil company straight away.
What was your view on that?
I said, I don't think you could have bought that experience. I mean, it really was a life-changing experience. And I think I went down to the Antarctic as a boy and probably came back as, you know, more of a man.
Well, let's look at what you did when you were down there, and that first, the so-called summer charlie, which in fact was actually a proper job.
Oh, yes.
Albeit only for
the
summer season. You're on board the Shackleton. What kind of things were you doing?
Well, basically, the Shackleton's main task was obviously resupplying the bases. But
it was also research.
Oh, yes.
There, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. But the research was done. We probably had about a two-week research programme. Sort of allocated to us, where we would not be resupplying bases. It was dedicated for doing the marine geophysics. However, in between this 2 weeks, we would obviously try and encourage the skipper, Captain Turnbull, Frosty Turnbull as his name was, to deviate slightly, for instance, leaving Port Stanley and going down to across to South Georgia, or leaving Port Stanley and going down to Deception Island. Because we'd obviously got survey tracks in, and we would be sort of trying to persuade him to go about 50 miles, 100 miles further west or further east. So we were getting a series of profiles.
You were literally mapping the bottom of the ocean, weren't you?
We were doing fundamental things like just bathymetry, just, you know, the water depth, with an echosounder driven by valves, enormous, probably about 4 foot high, these valves. And in those days, the biggest valve I had ever seen was probably about 4 or 5 inches high. These things were, you know, 3 or 4 feet high. So big power. I mean, we're talking about something like 6,000 fathoms water depth at most. So primary bathymetry survey, and very often because of the positional aids, which were sunshots, so if the weather was poor, we were just on dead reckoning. Very often during the interpretation, we would be actually repositioning lines on the bathymetric contours, on the, you know, on the water depth. So whilst we're doing this, we were also using the magnetometer and getting measurements of the Earth's magnetic field. And this was all worked up later at Birmingham to, I think there were a couple of universities, I think Lamont in the States and Birmingham were at the forefront of what was termed this crustal spreading, which was obviously plate tectonics. And
right, so the subtext was to see whether you could work out what had happened thousands of years ago.
Millions of years ago. I mean, basically, there's a crustal spreading centre within the Scotia Arc. And so as the molten mantle material comes up to the surface, it then spreads out to either side. of the fissure. And over millions of years, there have been what we call magnetic reversals, where the North Pole became a South Pole and the South Pole became a North Pole. So you can actually map these magnetic reversals on either side of the central ridge. The seismic work, obviously what we were finding from that was, in shooting the seismic work, sediments were very, very thin near the centre over the ridge because it was relatively young material, whereas further out from the ridge the sediments would become thicker. And obviously some of the stuff we did later became of major use for seismic exploration in the Falkland Islands.
At the time you were doing all this, was the plate tectonics theory fully accepted, or was it still debatable?
No, it was... I would say it was strongly believed, but the final positive proof... There were still doubters to it, but the final proof came out. And then, obviously, things like Gondwana land, you know, the whole movement of continents around the surface of the Earth, although appeared crazy, could be shown to be feasible because of the geophysics. And obviously paleontology showed that, you know, these plates, these continents, had been in different climates.
Mm-hmm. And animals are migrating from one to the other.
Correct, yeah.
Without having to get their feet wet.
Exactly, yeah.
You must have been learning a hell of a lot whilst all this was going on.
Yes, I mean, at this point, the degree was not... It was not... It didn't sort of lead me into questioning things. I guess I was very much a technologist, maintaining the equipment and operating the equipment, but obviously seeing the quality of the data. But the main learning academically came out on my... subsequent trip south, where I went down for 2 years, having completed the MSc course in Birmingham.
So when you were on board the Shackleton that summer, were you not picking up from the scientists you were working with their thinking?
Oh, yes.
You were. So yes. You were in the bar that night. You were.
Yes.
What does this mean then?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yes. There was clearly that those styles of conversation. But when you're working shifts, you know, there's a limit to how much you can take in. And if stuff breaks down, then there's, you know, it's 24 hours a day trying to get it fixed.
But did it break down?
But frequently, I think if you stick anything that's electronic in the water, salt water, even nowadays, it's a common problem that mix salt water and electronics and you're looking for problems.
What sort of lengths did you have to go to get things back on the road again, to get things fixed? You mentioned, but... The equivalent of burning the midnight oil.
Oh, yes, definitely burning the midnight oil. And
were you having to be inventive?
Yes. Yes.
Can you give an example of that?
Well, yeah, sort of rebuilding bits of the system on the magnetometer. Trying to fathom out how particular circuits worked and having to rebuild them such that they'd be more stable or wouldn't suffer... the glitches that we were finding. So at times we would and one of the things was this auto-tuning facility. I remember we just removed it all and just hand-tuned, but at least that got us back up on the road and we were collecting data again.
Was there a sense of excitement? Were you aware that you were actually making new discoveries? It was new science on new territory?
I don't think so. I think the new territory was pretty awe-inspiring. Things like just drifting on the Shackleton and making explosions and finding a school of whales coming up and sort of touching the side of the boat. I mean, the environment was just mind-blowing. But I don't think I was particularly at that point on my first trip was that enamoured with the geophysics of discovery.
Can you elaborate on that? What was putting you off? Was it just not your cup of tea?
Probably not my cup of tea at the time.
How frosty was Captain Turnbull? Was he willing to deviate to satisfy your requirements?
Occasionally. There were obviously routes to go and see the first mate, like John Cole, who was, was more malleable. So if you could approach John first to get the idea. I mean, Frosty was frosty enough that if I was standing a watch in the wheelhouse at the Echosander, I would have to knock on the bridge door, open it, go in, and say, permission to come on the wheelhouse.
After you got onto it?
Yes. Which, you know, having worked offshore in the oil and gas industry, was, you know, things like that just don't happen.
So there was a bit of old school about him, wasn't there?
Very much so, oh yes.
Did you respect him?
Oh yes, yes.
What was it about him that you found respectful?
He obviously was very, very capable. He obviously had mistakes. I remember him coming in, well, I guess it wasn't a mistake, I guess it was just circumstances. There was one trip we came into Port Stanley, and I don't think the Bass office in Port Stanley had informed him that they'd done some dredging around the end of the jetty. So he came in his normal style at probably about 6 knots, you know, slowed down to about 6 knots, thinking, because of the tidal state, that he'd just be driving the bottom of the boat onto the mud. But obviously, clearly, they dredged it. So he took out quite a bit of the end of the jetty. I also recall him, he was a sailor, as in yachting sailor. And I also recall him carrying his deck cargo, his own sailing yacht, which he took down south with him.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
To go around the Antarctic on a...
Well, he obviously didn't go around the Antarctic. He offloaded it in Port Stanley. And whenever we were in Port Stanley with a bit of time to spare, he used to go off sailing around.
Okay, so that kind of stuff was still okay in those days. You could still,
yeah.
You could get away with that kind of...
Yes, I think communications were obviously sparse.
Yeah, which is very helpful.
Compared with, you know, nowadays you see blogs and web.
What was the Shackleton like for doing science from? Because it wasn't designed specifically for that kind of thing.
She was effectively totally unmodified, apart from the fact that I think it might have been cabin 34, which was at the back of the boat at the aft end. I think they still had the two berths in, but we more or less had 19-inch racks of equipment. I think possibly they had put some cleaner 240-volt generators on her. And I think, I'm trying to remember whether it was my first trip doing marine geophysics or my second trip when I went down to winter, whether we actually had a compressor room. I know one of the trips I went down, I had to go down to Southampton and be trained on how to service an air compressor. And there was a little cubicle, let's say, or compartment built in the main ship's hold to house this compressor, such that we could get compressed air and run these things called air guns over the stern. But apart from that, it was all pretty basic.
And was there a regular or constant conflict between the practical needs of supplying bases and the logistical needs of supplying bases and the scientific ambitions of the scientists on board? Did it come to blows?
Not that I recall. I mean, clearly, there would be times when, if we did deviate a line and the weather was bad, I mean, it suited us because we would be near Hove 2. Making very slow progress, but getting much, much more data. And Frosty Turnbull frequently used to say to us, you know, is that bloody magnetometer still working? And we'd go, yeah, it's working fine. Because obviously he was looking to go somewhere for shelter, whereas we were obviously still out there, you know, trying to get the data. But no great problems or conflicts.
You mean he wanted to run for port and you were asking him to delay?
Yes.
Would he always?
No, he'd usually, if his words were, is that damn thing still working? And if it was, then that's fine. If it had broken down, then it obviously we'll get it back on board and we'll go and
So was that risk taking then from him, or was it, were you aware?
No. I think she was a fairly seaworthy boat. I mean, she was small, but my standards of ships that I've been on since. But no, she was a fairly seaworthy boat.
There were times when you worked side by side with a protector, weren't there? What was different about that?
Well, when we worked with protector, she would actually fire dynamite for us. So we would drift, and the protector would shoot away from us, as in travel away from us, firing explosives, probably the first one at a mile, the next one at 5 miles, the next one at 15, 20, 30, 40. And this was a technique called seismic refraction techniques, which where you do need a big distance. And from that you can get a what we call a velocity of acoustic propagation in the sub-seabed materials. And so you can start to infer what the rock types are. So that was protector's duty. But again, that used to be tight on what her commitments were and what the Shackleton could be doing. So there was obviously a bit of nitty-gritty trying to pull the two things together.
So one gets the impression that perhaps the scientist or the science was a bit of a hitchhiker.
Oh, yes, very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so. I mean, Prof Griffiths, I think when he first went south, he managed to sweetheart somebody within Bass, probably Ady, who was then, the chief editor, and obviously was, great bosom buddies with Fuchs. So I guess Griff started working at Birmingham in the sub-department of geology, which is where Ady, because in those days the research was not done like it is nowadays at one central facility like Cambridge. It really was farmed out to the different universities. So I guess Griff obviously got to know Ady in Staff House and persuaded Ady that you could have a free ride on the Shackleton and collect some data. So I guess that's how it started.
Is there anything else from that first summer on the Shackleton that you think would be valuable at this point, or should we move on? Anything I've not asked you about, Joshua?
Can't really think.
What kind of sailor were you?
The same sailor that I always have been in life. Probably takes me about, if it's flat calm, I can get my sea legs within about 3, 4, 5 days. If I go out to 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, terrible. And probably after about 10, 12, 14 days of bad weather, I eventually get my sea legs.
Right.
As soon as I get, if I stay offshore long enough, because that's primarily what I used to do in my subsequent working professional career. If I stay offshore long enough, get my sea legs, and then if I come home for leave, I could probably risk losing the sea legs, a period beyond 3, 4, 5 weeks, and just have to start again. But the wonderful thing about it is, unlike people that just do the cross-channel ferry and just want to die, I do know that I can get over it and live with it and just, no problem, can eat. And
so you got to the end of that summer and came back to the UK, Birmingham. Your contract was up, and that's when you began to find out about other possibilities.
Well, when I got, I think before I went south to do the marine geophysics, there were obviously lots of people in and out of the geophysics department. clearly one of the guys I met was Ian Flavel-Smith, my brother-in-law. But there's another guy called Jeff Renner. And Jeff had only just got back from Hope Bay and Stonington. I think he did Hope Bay first year and Stonington the second year. And Jeff, like myself, was ostensibly a Geordie. I think he was from Whitley Bay. And Jeff just recounted these dog-driving stories to me. And I just got hooked. Now, I had never had dogs as a pet at home, but Jeff's stories about driving dogs in the Antarctic just made me think this is wonderful. And then having met my brother-in-law, Ian Flavel-Smith, and discovered that he was doing the MSc course in geophysics, being paid by Bass as a scholarship, I thought, well, that's the surefire way of going down there and guaranteeing to get a dog team, because if you're doing geophysics, there's only one way you can do it, and that's to travel. So I guess those two things combined, before I actually sailed south to do the summer work, I'd actually applied for the Bass Scholarship in geophysics, which would be starting, you know, on my return, because they already had a candidate, which was Ian Flavin-Smith. So I obviously thought, this could be good. I obviously, if it turned out that I didn't like it, then there was obviously an opportunity of withdrawing. But when I got back, the marine geophysics programme was building, and I certainly went through a bit of a conscience pricker. And I remember Griff, the prof, calling me in to his office one day and trying to explain to me that we, Bass and the geophysics department at Birmingham, were all one big happy family, and that he really did think that I should not withdraw my application for the Bass Scholarship, and that, you know, they would find a replacement for me and manage without me. I think what Griff knew was that, fortunately for me, I'd been the only applicant for the MSc scholarship. So,
it seems that in your era, which is not that long ago, that actually Bass were struggling to recruit people, weren't they? That today, there are hundreds of applications for every single post.
Yeah.
Not the case in your day.
Yeah. Well, I'm obviously not aware of, you know, the current regime. Quite possibly. You know, if you're in geophysics, then you should really get into the oil and gas exploration. That's where the bread and butter would be. You know, join Shell or BP and be there for life, non-contributory pension scheme. Well, yeah, obviously things have changed.
So actually then you were shore-based in Birmingham for a whole year then, weren't you?
Yes, well, basically I think I fulfilled probably at least 12 months, if not some small extensions of the original contract to assist in the geophysics department. And then I guess there was the logical start for the MSc course, which I assume was probably going to be the sort of September-October time at university. So I just stayed working in the geophysics department until I then just stopped working there and became a student there to do the MSc course.
How was that course? Was it challenging?
It was most challenging. Again, there was, as I said, there was an intake either from people who had done geology degrees, or people that had done physics degrees or maths degrees, and also people that were coming in from industry. Usually the ones that were coming in for industry were paying for themselves for career advancement. And things that I had never understood, I'd never had any formal education in geology, so there were certainly some items that were just beyond me, and I did struggle with the geology. And I always remember we had an external examiner, who's Professor Martin Bott from Durham University, came down, and he almost lectured me towards the end of my interview with him, and saying that that I was in danger of becoming a geophysical technician rather than a true research geophysicist. And I think I quipped back at him, well, I didn't see anything wrong with becoming a geophysical technician. But, yes, the course was fairly hard work.
But you passed?
Yes. Just. Well, there was a bit of a complication. There was the course was obviously by there was a series of lectures on various topics in geophysics. But then there was a programme of field work, which probably lasted 2-3 weeks towards the end of the course. And we all went up to the Fylde area in Lancashire. And we were assisting the Fylde Water Board in trying to define the aquifer, you know, the water supply that is used for places like Blackpool. Because obviously reservoirs and rivers, if you're going to supply Blackpool in the summer, are pretty soon going to run dry. So the Fylde Water Board had quite a few boreholes that they would extract water from. Some of these were beginning to dry up. So we went up there using various geophysical techniques. In my particular case, I used gravity techniques to try and delineate where faults were, which obviously might be a hole where the water would just, you know, not get into the aquifer and leak off elsewhere. And I think I probably was very slow in getting my dissertation worked up and presented, to the extent that I was completing it when I went south. So I always remember when I got back, Ray Ady having a go at me, saying that I wasn't really fully qualified when I was a geophysicist in the Antarctic. I mean, he said nothing whilst I was down there. But he certainly was using this against me when I returned to try and get me onto a different salary scale.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
A lower one, you mean?
Obviously.
Yeah.
Or not to, you know, put me on the next highest one.
This is a bolt from the blue, but was dowsing frowned upon as a technique? Was that actually being used?
No. Griff, the prof, had used it in some of his work, because he'd obviously, in using dynamite, had, in UK, doing research projects, felt that if he could find a dowser, then there might be less damage to pipe work, to underground electrical cables. And certainly in those days, in the seismic industry on land, they used to employ dowsers, again, specifically for use in when we're using explosive work for seismic.
Was there ever any use of dowsing in the Antarctic?
No.
Okay. Shame. So you were heading... So you did this course and you eventually passed it one way or the other.
Yeah.
And you were heading south again, which is what you wanted.
Yes.
What was your next dollop of southness?
Well, the next dollop was obviously this... the attending Corpus Christi for the week's...
this was the
all conference. Having a drink and getting to know the sort of the Bass...
Was it Corpus Christi in those days?
Not
Girton.
No, it wasn't Girton. Right. I think it was Corpus Christi.
How was that for you? Because suddenly you were amongst...
Well, yes, it was... Peers. I mean, I had been almost on the periphery of Bass. Although I'd obviously got to know, you know, hundreds of FIDs during the first summer Charlie.
Because you were stopping at every...
We're stopping at every base. Yeah. So I was meeting FIDs that were going south and obviously FIDs that were coming back. And certainly after that first trip, as I said, I think I flew down to Uruguay at the start, but I came back on the Shackleton to Southampton. So, you know, you obviously got to know all the FIDs.
So at that conference then, you were actually being addressed by Dr. Fuchs himself.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What did you make of him? Because he was a different generation. Wasn't
he? Absolutely. I mean, and I think around that time he'd been caught in the press, or hounded in the press. It's probably a better way of putting it. He'd been interviewed, and some guy in the press had sort of said to him that what a waste of public money this was, you know, sending these guys down to the Antarctic. And Fuchs came out with what I think is a probably typical comment for the man, that, you know, far better we do things like that and train, you know, guys to become British gentlemen. Which I think was his, you know, his outlook on life. So he was very much old school.
Did he have a charisma which you recognise?
Oh yes.
Can you describe that?
I think his whole presence, you know, the beard and the stories, the E-type Jag, the stories of the legendary story of the TAE expedition where they'd collected seismic data and he'd travelled from Cambridge down to London. There was a geophysicist on the TAE, I can't remember the name's guy, the guy's name, but Fuchs wanted to get all the data from Bass back up to Cambridge to get somebody to start working on it. And apparently it was a lovely day in London, so he gets out from Gillingham Street with this old vase or something with all these seismic records stuffed into it, and he parks it by the boot of his E-Type, and then he takes his hood down and drives off. And I think he probably got halfway between London and Cambridge and realised he left all these seismic records. So I had to go back down and get him. So, yes, he was quite a legendary character.
So here you are then, you've finished your introductory course.
Yep.
And you're back on the Shackleton.
Yep.
Heading south. Did you have any idea where you were going and what you were going to do?
Oh, yes, I knew that it was Stonington.
What was your task going to be?
At Stonington, field geophysics. My brother-in-law, Ian Flavel-Smith, who was just another guy at the time, was already down there. So I knew I was going to join Ian. I obviously had as quite a few of the scientific FIDs know, geologists and geophysicists, the sealed orders from Raymond J. Adey, which we were not allowed to open until I think we'd crossed the equator.
That's true, isn't that?
That's
that,
absolutely true.
That legend.
Yeah, that is an absolute true legend.
Were you ever tempted?
No, not really. I mean, there were so nondescript burns. You shall survey using gravimetric and magnetometric techniques areas bounded by latitude and longitude and latitude and longitude with, you know, four coordinates, which was literally ginormous. So it was complete free scope.
Right, okay. So why was he doing that? What did he ever get to the bottom of why Adey did it?
No, he was a bit of a strange, pernickety character.
Eccentric?
Yes, sometimes a pain in the arse. He would focus on minutia.
Your brief is actually very broad.
Yes, but the minutia would be, you're not allowed to see this. Nobody must know this until you've crossed the equator. And I don't know whether the guy was a bit insecure and, you know, wanted to stay in control. Hmm. So, you know, you weren't allowed to read it or tell anybody.
So how was that? When you crossed the equator, did you all then die for your envelopes?
Well, you all died for the envelopes. So I think he might have given them to Frosty Turnbull such that, you know, we'd be handed them. So we obviously looked at them, read them, had a giggle, and had a few beers, and got on with it.
Compared notes?
Not necessarily. But, I mean, I knew where I was going in any case, because I think I was in correspondence with Ian Flavel-Smith via his family.
Right. So he was expecting you to join him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I knew I wasn't going to go to Halley, and the only other place on the peninsula that there was any geophysics being done was Stonington.
When you got to Stonington, I appreciate you had been there before, but when you suddenly found yourself living there, what was it like?
There was the acclimatisation of staying on the ship, because I was obviously borrowed again by the geophysics department
on the way
to do marine geophysics.
So you did some more work?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yes. And I think it was... I think Ian Flavel-Smith was making noises like, you know, get your backside down to Stonington ASAP, and obviously the guys from Birmingham Geophysics Department and the research fellow was a guy called Peter Barker, was on board, and he was obviously trying to hang on to me for as long as he could. So,
just to interject there, you'd actually spent some time at Stanley, hadn't you?
Oh, yes.
There was a delay there as well.
Yes, I think Stanley, I can't honestly remember why there was a delay, but I remember getting off in Stanley. And there was a surveyor called Paul Bentley, and the pair of us, I was his chain man. We went out and did a survey of what for a runway area, and I think the Falklands government were looking into noises that had been made by the Argentinians of putting a runway in, which would be serviced by Aerolíneas Argentinas or Argentinians. And the Argentinians, I think, were saying politically that, you know, you could go to Argentina, go to hospital there, and it would be far easier than catching the Darwin up to Montevideo. So there was certainly that period in Port Stanley. I think in the first year I had a delay, which was at Deception Island, when I got off the Shackleton at Deception, we probably had about 50 or 60 tons of naval demolition charges, which were in true Bass or Birmingham University Geophysics Department, were stored in a couple of old whalers' wooden huts. So they dumped me off, probably to go and do some resupply where they weren't going to be collecting data. And by hand, myself and a guy called Sean Norman, who eventually came base leader at Stonington, he was a Met man in those days at Deception, that year at Deception. The two of us floored out one of the old whaling tanks, steel whaling tanks, fitted a door on it, and manhandled this all this dynamite into the whaling tank. So that was a strengthening experience.
Was it dangerous?
No. It was just TNT. Mm. So obviously we moved primers and detonators separately. And we'd actually had, I'd been on a naval demolition course at HMS Vernon, which was a naval facility. Obviously the name of the boat, but it was a shore facility down in either Southampton or Portsmouth. So we were let loose with Navy charges and showed what to do with them.
Just going back to the Stanley runway surveying, at the time, were you fairly convinced this runway would ever get built?
No, I had no idea. I mean, you know, frequently, I remember Lord Chalfont went down at some stage. I guess I don't think he was actually the Minister for Foreign Affairs, but he was fairly high up in the Foreign Office. And he went down, and it was common knowledge that he was trying to persuade the Falkliners to accept more of Argentinian input or involvement in the Falklands. And I remember, I think this was my first harping back and jumping around a bit, but back to the Summer Charlie trip on the Shackleton. I do recall Frosty Turnbull probably at that time being fairly keen that we stopped running the magnetometer. We've got to get to Port Stanley quick. And so Chalfont came down on the Protector, and Frosty had us with loudspeakers out of all the portholes on one side, playing Land of Hope and Glory as the Protector went in through the Narrows into Port Stanley.
So even then, in the mid-60s, there was a certain amount of political agitation between Britain and Argentina.
Yeah. I don't think in my time offshore, I never, on the Shackleton, we never ever had any problems. But certainly, I think 2, 3, 4 years later, Shackleton was actually fired at by an Argentinian Navy ship, which is well chronicled, but I wasn't around.
Okay. So you got to Stonington and you settled in at Stonington?
Well, part and parcel of Ian Flavel-Smith trying to get me off the Shackleton PDQ pretty quick was that he had got permission from Bass to do a winter programme. And so I got to Stonington, but was only there about 3 or 4 days, if memory serves me correctly, whereupon I immediately turned round. I think I was probably on the Biscoe. I think we must have transferred somehow onto the Biscoe from Shackleton. And the John Biscoe then took 4 of us, which was Ian Sykes, mountaineer and general assistant, Pete Rowe, geologist, who'd been at Cygni his previous year, Ian Flavel-Smith, geophysicist, and myself, geophysicist, 2 dog teams. We went up to Horseshoe Island, where there was an excellent base. And Ian Sykes had organised a hell of a lot of work with different teams going up there and refurbishing the hut. And so we had a winter at Horseshoe before I actually, let's say, settled and moved in to get myself a berth at Stonington. And that was a great trip, being around the fjords, which was obviously an introduction to sledging and sea ice, which was fairly relatively safe, you know, amongst the fjords, and fantastic scenery.
How did it take to dog sledging?
Well, it was fairly simple at that point because I didn't have a dog team for the first year. So basically I either travelled with Ian or more often travelled with Ian Sykes, with the bits of geophysics being trailed or mounted on the sledge. So Ian obviously was doing the sledging, but I just thought it was wonderful. Great fun to see those little tails bobbing up and wagging and happy dogs.
Are you a doggy man anyway? Or were you...
No, I probably, when I was at home, used to find stray cats like they were going out of fashion. And my mother's, you know, you're not bringing another stray cat into this house. But just took to dogs. And since, you know, coming back from FIDS, I think the first time we had a house with a fairly decent-sized garden, just went out and bought two dogs.
Not huskies.
No. Just a couple of bog-standard working dogs. I certainly wanted to go for a working dog. I wouldn't have entertained, I think, really having huskies.
What is it about dogs in the Antarctic? Why do grown men get all misty-eyed?
Well, I guess it's... I mean, once you get to the point of having your own dog team, I think it's the family thing. You're responsible. You know, you've got to look after this family of nine dogs. I mean, you know, we know there have been occasions, and especially there was one at Horseshoe, where I think three dog teams and maybe three or four guys went off. Major breakup in the sea ice. Search parties once the sea ice had refrozen. And the dogs started coming back probably 3-4 weeks later. So we know they can survive, but you do feel responsible for them, you know, stitching them up when the fights are too bad and feeding them. And you might be down, and if they're up and they're happy, it just, you know, comes onto you.
So they're a psychological boost, are they?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Great days were the long days, and the dogs' tails are still up at the end of the day. The bad days are, you know, poor surfaces and rolling sledges over and scraping the ice off the runners. But the good days were just tremendous.
There's another mode of transport which perhaps wasn't completely approved of, which was a certain canvas canoe.
Yes. Well, that was Horseshoe, which obviously, Ian Sykes being mountaineer and outdoor pursuits man, ex-RAF Mountain Rescue, had built a canvas-covered canoe at Stonington. Now, how the hell he smuggled it on board the Pisco without the skipper spotting it? And
it was in one piece of it.
Yeah. Oh yes, it was built. It was completed. So I always remember Ian when we with the first week at Stonington coming along to me saying, and obviously I knew Ian Smith because I'd climbed with Ian and spent some time with him, shared a flat with him in Birmingham. But Ian, obviously, as, let's say, the overall leader, or the one fully qualified mountaineering guy with us, was obviously sounding me out as to, you know, how capable I was, whether I was going to be a, you know, absolute liability in climbing or walking up crevasse fields or whatever. And I remember him showing me this canoe that he'd made. And obviously I said, "Whoa, it's a PBK 15. I built one of these when I was, you know, when I was at school, and then I built the PBK 20. "Oh, you've done a bit of canoeing." "Oh, yeah." "Well, do you want a shot of it?" "Oh, yeah." So I think I borrowed it, and out we went. Now, I can't honestly say whether we had life jackets, but off we went, and I think I was probably away for, a good 20, 40 minutes, maybe an hour. And I can't remember whether, I think there might have been a flare go off at back at Horseshoe Base. Obviously, there was a bang, and I looked, and there was this bright light up in the sky. And I thought, "Oh, better get back." And I got quite a rollicking from Ian as to, you know, how long I'd been away and that he was worried. And I guess he probably was worried, because had there been an incident, it would have all come out in the wash as to who built this damn thing. And who was sort of maybe responsible for an incident.
So was it never used again?
Um, I think it was used periodically, but I mean, as soon as the sea ice came, that was it.
Yeah.
It didn't get used again.
Let's just pause for a moment and then we'll pick up from where we left off.
Right.